It's McCallum, it's Shannon, it's the Bob McCallum podcast. And hockey talk today, Shannon. I know this is your
wheelhouse. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Good idea.
This is, yeah. Shocking, isn't it, folks? He is the managing general of the Seattle Kraken, the newest entry into the National Hockey League. Ron Francis will join us. And he has an interesting challenge ahead of him. It's always a challenge to launch a new franchise. He's doing it in a market that has a level of familiarity with the sport of hockey and a history with the sport of hockey. Mm-hmm. Unlike Vegas, unlike Carolina, where he played, unlike Hartford, where he played. So it'll be intriguing to me to listen to how that difference is affecting him and has affected the way they put this franchise together. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, the one thing I would suggest is that this is an ownership group that has truly spared no expense. You know, they're going to, between the combination of the owners of the arena and the owners of the team, they're going to have spent about $1.7 billion for the franchise and the arena. These are people with deep pockets. They have not cut corners. They have done it through a great deal of principle. They're probably going to be the most diverse franchise in the history of the National Hockey League when it comes to hiring practices. What Seattle has done is a blueprint in many, many ways, Bob, for how an expansion franchise could work. And we said the same thing about Vegas 4 years ago. And it's changed again with what the people, David Bonderman, Tim and Todd Lywicki, and Ron Francis have been able to do over the last 2 years. It's truly remarkable what they've done.
We'll commence conversing. Ron Francis, the general manager of the Seattle Kraken, this time. We'll begin after these messages. Well, the National Hockey League welcomes a new member this season. I don't have to tell anybody about that. I think everybody's been well aware of it. Seattle finally gets their NHL team named the Kraken. And Ron Francis joins us to chat a little bit about this. Have you become comfortable with the Kraken name, Mr. Francis?
I love the Kraken name. Yeah, I'm more than comfortable with it.
Well, how involved were you in the process of making the decision?
Actually, I was fortunate. Todd Lywicki, our president, had me involved right from day one in the selection of the name, and then rolled over from there into the design of the logo and the jerseys and so on and so forth. So, yeah, right from the early stages, I was a part of it, and really happy with the name we landed on.
That's interesting. You don't see hockey ops guys get too involved in that. So That must have been very satisfying to feel that you were being allowed to give in your 2 cents, and maybe you can see a little bit of it in their new sweaters.
Yeah, I know, it was exciting. And then, I've got kids that are kind of in the late 20s, so I was able to sort of incorporate them into the process to make sure that, you know, the old man wasn't sort of off his rockers in some of the thought process, to get some sort of a younger, fresher look at it from my kids too. So it was a really cool process to be involved in and be able to incorporate them in the process as well.
So give us a bit of the behind the scenes on this. And, I've been in a cursory way involved with some franchises when names were came up. And often the franchises like to say, well, the fans chose it. When was the first time you heard the name Kraken, and do you remember who suggested it, or did it actually come from the fan base?
Yeah, I think before I got here, they had sent out almost a competition, and they received, I want to say it was like 1,100 different names and variations. And then as a group, they tried to narrow it down again. So Kraken was one of the names I had heard when I first came on board and was a part of it. We were kind of leaning in a little bit of a different direction with some different names. I remember having a conversation with a young lady that worked for us, Heidi Detmar, at the time. And I said, Heidi, explain to me about the Kraken. What does that mean to you and stuff? And she's from the area, and she talked about her grandparents and the folklore of the Kraken and how these extremely intelligent animals live in the Puget Sound. And so I listened to her kind of story, and you know, I was talking with Todd Lywicki, our president, and a couple of days later, and he said, you know, which one are you leaning towards? I said, I'm leaning towards Kraken. And he said, really? And told him about the story with Heidi. And so that, you know, it was sort of in the mix as we moved forward. And then, you know, as we kept working through it and working through it and trying to figure out a logo that matched with a name, you know, the one thing for us was making sure our logo was more along the lines of iconic than gimmicky. And I think with the work of Adidas and our ownership, we were able to accomplish that for sure.
The interesting thing about your involvement during the COVID time was a lot of it was done remotely. How much of a challenge was that through this process?
Yeah, I mean, it was a challenge in a lot of different aspects, John. I mean, we sent all our people home. I think it was in early February of 2000 that year. So we sent everybody home, and we're working remotely ever since. And you know, you're trying to do these meetings via Zoom. So, you know, is the color really accurate or is it not? Is the logo really what it looks like in person or not? So, you know, it wasn't just on the design of the logo, it was everything we did, even hiring the staff and personnel. I mean, a lot of those interviews were done on the phone or on Zoom, and then you're hiring people that you didn't get to meet till, you know, 12, 14 months later, finally when we had the expansion draft in person.
I don't need to tell you or anybody else out there. You know, Seattle has a baseball team, the one that's actually in a race with the Toronto Blue Jays for a playoff spot. A very good football team, have been very good for a number of years. Had a basketball team for many years, and now an NHL franchise. How do you look upon the relationship between your team and the existing two major professional franchises in Seattle? Is it a competition, or are there things you can work together on?
Yeah, no, I think the relationships are great. You know, my president, my boss, Todd Lywicki, was part of the Seahawks and getting that up and running. He has strong relationships with the Mariners ownership there. The Sounders, the pro soccer team here, right. One of our owners here is the owner of that, Adrian Hanauer. So we have good relationships with the other pro sports team in town, and they've been great to reach out with and have dialogue with. And as we've sort of moved through this process, and it's sort of a give and take, and everybody's willing to help each other, which is exciting, especially in this market, us being the new guy in the block coming into it.
Do you get a sense of what kind of sports town Seattle is now, Ronnie? As it's, I mean, you were in Raleigh, where it's a college town, and Pittsburgh, it's, you know, this with the Steelers and the Pirates, and Hartford before that. What kind of sports town do you think Seattle is?
Oh, it's a huge sports town. You know, I love telling the story. I mean, the league said to our ownership group, you've got 6 weeks to get 10,000 season ticket deposits. And we accomplished that in 12 minutes. I mean, 12 minutes to get 10,000 season ticket deposits. And then we ended up with, I think it was 25,000 in the first hour and 32,000 the first day, had to cut it off. So we have another waiting list of people that want to get onto the waiting list for tickets. That's a huge number as well. So, and you watch the, you know, when the Sounders play and the people, you know, parading through the streets as they head to the soccer stadium, and the Seahawks and the 12th man and the raising of the flag, and the Mariners now, you know, back in the hunt and in the drive. I mean, it is a huge sports town, and it's, you know, it's more along the lines, I guess, when I was in Pittsburgh with the Steelers and the Pirates and that kind of stuff. But excited to be in this market, and excited to bring hockey back to this market. People are really excited to watch the first game.
Sounds like you should have built a bigger arena.
We could have put more people in.
Well, it raises, it's kind of a stupid question, but, you know, what's the biggest arena in the NHL now, John?
Montreal.
It used to be Chicago, right?
Yeah, I think it was Chicago or Montreal, I think.
So that's around 20 or a little, maybe a tad over 20.
Yeah.
Like, how big could you go? I wonder. what's the biggest arena you could realistically build without angering the guys sitting up in the nosebleed section? I mean, could you go 25, Ronnie? Do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I know that would they do the one at the Big House there in Michigan, the outdoor game, but I'm sure some of those seats were not great at watching the ice. But you know, I know in our building we're right around 17-1, but it's a real intimate setting. You walk in on the main level, there's only about 30 rows up, everything else is sort of subterranean, and you know, it's kind of a little bit of a steeper pitch. I think it's going to be an intimate setting. And I think there really isn't a bad seat in the house. Even the people in the so-called nosebleeds are going to have great views of the ice. So I think that's important too, making sure that people get a great view for the money they're spending as well.
What kind of role have been to Seattle? What part of the city is the arena in?
So our main rink is right next to the Space Needle. It's on that Seattle campus. It is the old Key Arena, but want to make it perfectly clear, it is a brand new arena. They they kept the roof because it was historically a historical structure back from the World Fair back in, I think it was 62. Right. Everything else was ripped out. They dug down in the ground, built a brand new state-of-the-art arena from the ground up. And then Amazon put the Climate Pledge arena name on top of it with the goal of making our arena the first ever net carbon zero arena by 2023-24. Pretty interesting facility.
And what kind of role did you have in developing the innards of that arena?
So on the Climate Pledge arena, they said, here's your 15,000 square feet that you have for your locker room. And Ricky Olchek and I flew to Kansas City, met with the architects from Populous, and basically designed that from the ground up. Thought we were done, and then started getting carpet samples and paint samples and tile samples. And, you know, so we went through that whole process. But, you know, and then on the flip side, we had the same thing with our Kraken Community Iceplex here that Starbucks has sponsored. You know, we built a three-sheet arena with a 18,000 square foot locker room there. Our offices are situated above the locker room. And Dave Tippett was here before me, had done a lot of work on filling that out. But and then when I came in, we kind of worked on making some tweaks. And again, same thing, had to fill out all the carpets and paints and you name it. But it's certainly a lot of work when you're in the middle of it. But now that it's complete, it's pretty exciting to say you were part of that for sure.
Boy, it doesn't hurt to have corporate partners, big names like Starbucks, headquartered in Seattle, Amazon, headquartered in Seattle. I'm sure the guys at Microsoft are knocking on the door too to try to figure out what to do and how to be involved. The one thing about Seattle as a market, Ron, the league has always said that hockey fans are above the norm when it comes to tech savvy, and Seattle's a tech savvy city. Do you see that in anything what you're doing right now with your hockey club?
Yeah, absolutely, John. I mean, our goal is to, in some of the spaces we have in our arena, to incorporate sort of the Amazon, sort of the touchless system. We just walk in, you're already pre-registered, pick out what you want and walk out. You don't have to stop and pay in line and stuff. We are in the process of building and creating our own app. I think we'll be the first pro sports team for sure in the NHL that has designed its own app that, you know, fans can pre-register again coming in, and a lot of things they can do, a lot of stats they can follow during the game, all via their link on this app. Everything from parking and traffic to ticketing to sales and merchandise to ordering drinks and food to, you know, things that are happening on the ice. So it's pretty cool, a lot of things that they're developing that I think will be unique to the NHL at this point.
With Ron Francis of the Seattle Kraken, John and I've had numerous conversations with George McPhee over the years, from when he took over in Vegas. And, we can get into this a little bit more in terms of the comparisons, but one of the things that they did is they built their practice arena in Summerlin. And I used to live in Vegas, so I'm familiar with where it is, and it's basically essentially a residential community. And what's happened is the players, most of them wind up buying or renting or whatever they do in the area. So they're literally minutes away from the practice arena. Were you able to do that with yours?
No, we didn't put it in a residential area. We took an old sort of mall area called Northgate. And that's where we kind of built our facility, tore down some structures. I think in time you'll see this kind of develop into whether it's, you know, movie theaters and residential apartments and restaurants and all that kind of stuff, and sort of redo the whole neighborhood in that regard. But at this point, that is not the case. But it's 7 miles north of where our big rink is. And I think our guys will live. There's so many different unique little sort of areas in Seattle that you can live. Some will live in Queen Anne, which is 5 minutes from the big rink and 10 minutes from the practice. Others will probably live across in Bellevue, which is probably you know, 12 minutes from the practice facility and, you know, 15 to 20 from the big rink. So, but I think in time, that's what will happen. You know, in Carolina, they did something similar, not the team, but there was an area called North Hills Mall that was kind of old and run down, and they knocked that down and rebuilt that whole area. And now it's got like 5 major hotels, all kinds of restaurants and stuff. So I think that's what will happen in the Northgate area that we're building our practice rink in for sure.
I'm going to guess that, you know, Hartford, Carolina, you had to build a hockey base there. And that one of the things you probably were involved in was, conceptually at least, was building arenas, building ice surfaces so that people could play the game. Because we all know if you play, you're going to be a fan. Seattle has a long history of hockey. Is part of the plan with the Kraken to expand the number of ice surfaces that are available?
Well, I mean, I think it started with our practice. So it would have been easy to build one sheet for us or two sheets if that's what we wanted, but the owners decided to put a third sheet in. So we have 3 sheets on our practice facility, which is a big significant and want to give back to the community in that regard. We've already had, you know, women's hockey and you know, sled hockey and men's leagues and Kraken junior Kraken tryouts and all kinds of stuff happening on the ice surface, which is great. I know they've worked with some of the other local, you know, hockey programs in the market and some of the other arenas to make sure that they're helping them and that those stay in business and we can grow the sport, not just in our backyard, but throughout the state of Washington. So that is the plan for sure.
That's a good question. Where do you think minor hockey is? How well developed is minor hockey, or in the United States they call it youth hockey? How well developed is youth hockey in the Seattle area?
I had a lot of discussions probably in the last year before COVID hit. We had some face to face stuff with the different youth hockey programs, and it seemed like it was pretty good, John. You know, there are some challenges, I think, especially through the pandemic and maybe some of the rinks sort of surviving just based on you know, the tough part of the you know, pandemic happening. But I know our group has met with a lot of those youth organizations to help try and structure that and build it. With our 3 sheets here, we think that adds to it. One thing I've heard is when the kids sort of get to that 14, 15, 16 age group, a lot of them have to leave Seattle to go play in better markets. And I think what we're hoping is in time, we can change that. You know, we want to build something here that not only people are able to stay and play in their backyard, but maybe other people want to come in and be a part of as well too. But certainly the junior programs with the Seattle Thunderbirds, the Everett Silvertips, you know, being close by, I think that sort of, if we can build that sort of liaison and sort of roll it into that Western Hockey League stuff, would be great for us moving forward.
Have the junior teams been receptive to what you've done and come to town? Because Everett particularly in Seattle, they do have really good fan bases, but you know, they've kind of owned the market.
Yeah, no, I know we've had different discussions with them. Todd especially has reached out and you know, we're actually playing our exhibition games this year, not in our new arena, but in Kent with the Thunderbirds. And then we're playing at Everett with the Silvertips, and then we're going to play in Spokane with the Chiefs there too. So we are, you know, trying to reach out and do things with them as well to help them moving forward.
The other aspect, I mean, every guy that you drafted, every guy that you've signed, every guy on the management side in hockey ops is a level playing field. How have you created an orientation for everybody to come to town? I mean, if I had signed a deal in Seattle and was part of your group, what would the organization have done for me to make sure that I understood what was going on in Seattle?
Yeah, so we worked hard on that ahead of the expansion draft, because we knew once we drafted our guys, we had basically 60 days to explain the market and get them in here and get them settled. So we had a complete book and even actually in PDF form where we sent it out immediately to all our players that we drafted, all the people started working for us, explained kind of the city of Seattle, state of Washington, the different neighborhoods, what they had, where shopping was, where restaurants were, where doctors would be located, where school systems would be, all that kind of stuff to try and make it a lot easier for our people as they come in. And then we also had a moving company in place that we worked with. So, hey, this guy's in whatever, the state of Florida, the state of North Carolina, the state of or the province of Ontario. We need to get them into town. How do we get them here most effectively and easiest for them and their family? And I will say our staff has worked extremely well on that. And so far, it's worked well. We're what, 10 days out from camp or so. You know, so it's exciting that it's right around the corner. And so far, everybody's in town and seems to be enjoying what they're seeing.
I don't have to tell you that if your wife and your children are happy, you have a good life. And that's really the key to this, isn't it?
Well, that's what we're trying to do, is make sure the wives understand, especially if they have, we have a lot of players with kids. So making sure where the school systems are, where the doctors will be locating, making sure that that process, if they need a doctor, is pretty simple. If they want to bring their kids to the game, making sure that, you know, in our case, we're going to offer some babysitting so that they can bring their kids and have them sort of stay in the wives' room and be tended to while they watch the game, but yet they're still there with them in the facility.
This may sound like a stupid question, but I don't think I've ever asked it before. I just operate under the assumption that most players, when they come to a new city, and in the case of Seattle, a new team, would at least begin by renting rather than buying something. Is that the case, or do you know?
I think it's somewhat mixed. I think it depends on the term of the contract, whether the guys feel more comfortable buying or renting. I think it does make sense in a lot of cases. If you want to rent, it just sort of get to know the city better, yeah. Especially one of this size. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but I've heard from our guys probably more renting than buying, but there are people on both sides of that fence.
Ron Francis is with us, the general manager of the Seattle Kraken. We'll take a break, come back with more after these messages. Bob McCowan, it's John Shannon on the podcast and on SiriusXM. Ron Francis is with us, the GM of the
Come on, let's Kraken. Get into the team now. We got to get into this team now. We've done 20 minutes of stuff of Ronnie's nice stuff, and he's got the good speech going. Now let's get into the brass tacks.
Well, if you stop throwing softballs at him, then maybe we'll get some put some meat on the bone. Look, we talked. I mentioned George McPhee earlier, and there's, and I think you know this and understand this. There's inevitably going to be a comparison between your franchise and the Vegas situation, even though it was 4 years ago or whatever it was.
Right.
When you looked at what McPhee did in terms of strategically building the franchise, you couldn't exactly follow that blueprint, even if you wanted to, because the situation is different. But he did take a different approach. Tell me what you think of what he did, and how much might it have influenced the decisions that you and your organization made?
Yeah, no, I think you look back and what George and his team did was remarkable. You know, as you said, you know, a lot of the decisions they made affected us, but probably in a different way, and that we weren't going to be able to do the things that they did because, you know, the previous expansion before Vegas was in 2000, they were in 2017. So it was 17 years. A lot of the GMs hadn't been through it. The rules came into play. There were a new set of rules. I think the teams got them just over a year out. So they didn't have as much time to sort of jockey their roster or lineups to do it. And I think when guys look back on it, they'd say, okay, if I had to do that again, I would do it differently in this aspect or that aspect. In our case, it was 4 years previous that they had expansion. So these guys have been through the rules, understood them differently. We're in the middle of a pandemic with a flat cap. So that changed maybe sort of some of how they're thinking of perspective as well too. So it was a totally different scenario for us. You know, the other thing with Vegas, they had nobody sitting on the outside that could affect the expansion draft. We had Vegas sitting on the outside who didn't lose a player to us in the expansion draft, but could affect the expansion draft and did. Ultimately, they made, I think it was two trades days before the expansion draft happened. So that affected, I think, three or four different teams' rosters at that point. Nothing they did wrong. Those were the rules, but there were certainly differences from when they went through it, from when we went through it. So to sit there and say we were going to get the same kind of ransom that Vegas got in a lot of the situations, I think was naive. You know, we tried to approach it from a different approach. We're asking our fans to pay a lot of money. If I was going to take on dead money or bad contracts, then it certainly had to be worth our time to do that. Otherwise, our plan was to try and go in a different direction and maintain as much salary cap as we could. And then potentially, you know, we could target guys during the expansion window where they, if they were a free agent that wasn't being protected, we could talk to, or a week later when we got to free agency, maybe trying to get some guys in that window as well.
Are you satisfied with the roster that you put together as we sit here right now, or is it still a work in progress for you?
Well, I think it's always a work in progress.
Sure.
you know, I mean, when you look at teams, the hardest thing, and I think Vegas would say the same thing, the hardest thing is when teams protect seven forwards, they're going to protect their top six and they're going to protect their third line centerman. So it's hard to get kind of the elite high end playmaking centerman that can affect your roster and your scoring, you know, easier than most other players in your lineup. So, I mean, that's an ongoing process for us for sure. But I think, you know, we were pleasantly surprised that Philip Grubauer became available on free agency day and we were able to get him. We think our goaltending is solid. We like our back end. We think our back end's good. And we think we've got an experienced group up front with also some young kids in the mix. And, you know, we think that we got a lineup that's going to work and compete hard every night. And we'll have to see how the scoring goes and the special teams go for us moving forward. But, you know, we're pleased with where we're at. We still have more work to do for sure.
Ronnie, you, the Grubauer signing, did you have your fingers crossed that he would be available on free agency when you drafted Driedger on expansion draft day? Did you have a concept that Grubauer would be available?
No, I mean, all those guys' names are out there, but 99% of them get signed by their own team prior to getting there. Like it was Grubauer and Landeskog. And so you're sitting there thinking, well, maybe we'll get, you know, a crack at one of those guys in free agency, but normally that doesn't happen. We were very comfortable with Driedger and Vanecek and Decord as our three goaltenders coming out of expansion. And then when that happened on free agency day, certainly we made the call and we're excited that we were able to get him signed with us. And that sort of, you know, in our minds, solidified our goaltending even further.
Well, I'm always, John and I have this conversation all the time. I'm always surprised that people in the sport, we all know how important goaltending is. You don't win anything if you don't have good goaltending. And of course, there are many variables and things that can happen over the course of a year that can impact what your plans were, but you better have a good goaltender if you're going to have any kind of success. And yet goaltenders are generally speaking, not drafted at the top of the draft. It's like you can't win in the NFL without a good quarterback. And everybody's looking for a quarterback at the top of the draft. As a guy who used to whistle pucks past goaltenders for a lot of years, can you explain to me why it's so difficult to draft an 18-year-old goaltender?
But I think you kind of answer your own question when you say 18 years old. I mean, that's the whole risk, right?
Ronnie, what's the difference between an 18-year-old goaltender and an 18-year-old defenseman? Because you'd also agree that a defenseman, generally speaking, you can't really judge them until they're 22, 24, 25 years old.
Yeah, no, I think the goaltending comes with so much more pressure in that situation, right? As a young kid and you draft a guy at 18 in the first round. I mean, there's been some that have turned out, some that haven't. It's like every other position, I guess, but
yeah,
especially with goaltenders, it's such a critical position. You know, you take them at 18 and there's a lot of pressure and added to them in that role. It's hard to project, I think, more so on a goaltender. There are some you feel pretty confident on, but it's a lot harder to project that guy moving forward. Whereas you may be able to find that guy in the third round or fourth round that's a little bit of a late bloomer, but has the size and the technique and is still going to sort of pan out. So it is a, you know, as a GM, you sleep a hell of a lot better if you have a good goaltender in between your pipes. But, you know, and there are times you look at, I mean, there's two drafted in the first round this year as well, right? So there are guys you draft in the first round. It's just, it's challenging at 18 years old drafting anybody and projecting forward.
So do you think it's easier to teach, coach, develop a goaltender than it is a forward or defenseman?
Probably say harder.
Probably harder, huh?
Yeah, I mean, you're the last line of defense, right? If I'm a centerman, I make a mistake, my wingers can bail me out, or my defense can bail me out, or my goaltender can bail me out. If I'm a D and I make a mistake, my goalie can bail me out. If I'm the goaltender, I make a mistake, everybody's looking at me. And it takes a special breed to play that position. It takes a special mindset to be able to handle that sort of pressure, especially at the critical times over the course of the season into the playoffs. And I think it's just a lot harder position to play than the other ones, you know, because it's so zeroed in on and focused on knowing when you're doing well and when you're not.
The you talked about being able to almost spend as much as you want and spending to the cap. When did you get an indication from ownership that you're going to be allowed to do that?
When I was interviewing for the job.
Really?
two plus years ago. Yeah. I mean, they were, you know, that was their game plan. They wanted to build a team that was successful and wanted to win. You know, they gave me the green light right out of the gate. You want to go hire a coach now, you get the green light to go do it. So they've been fantastic right from day one and how they've operated. And, you know, that was sort of our plan moving forward. You know, we still have some cap space for this year, but it also allows us, I think, as we build this moving forward, as you get into next summer's free agency as well, too, is sort of starting to ramp up towards hitting the cap number.
You mentioned coach. Dave Hackstall is your guy. I think, quite honestly, I think you did a marvelous job keeping it a secret, which is, you know, the Ron Francis, that's one of your brands, is keeping things a secret. But why Dave Hackstall in the end, and how was he involved in your expansion draft discussions?
I first met Dave in 19 when I was part of the Hockey Canada World Championship team playing in Slovakia. The management team also included Jason Botterill and Ron Hextall. So Vigneault was a head coach, Muller was on the staff, Lindy Ruff was on the staff, and Dave was on the staff. And got to spend time with him. I think the first thing was we needed two guys to volunteer to drive over to Brno, Czechoslovakia, to watch the Finns and the Swedes from Austria. And Dave and I were the two that volunteered. So we spent the time in the car driving over and driving back and just talking hockey and family and life, and got to know him a little bit as a person like that. Had conversations with Ron Hextall while I was over there, just about him and his coaching style and what he was all about. You know, at that point, I didn't have a job, but it was just sort of gathering knowledge and stuff. And as I moved forward in the Seattle position, certainly he was a name that sort of intrigued me. You look back at his record, you know, 11 years as a head coach in North Dakota, seven of those seasons, he had a winning percentage over 600. The other four, he had a winning percentage over 700. He went into Philly. He was there for 4 years. Two of the first three, he made the playoffs. Third year when he got let go, I think it was 28 games in. And when you do a deeper dive into it, it wasn't like the team was playing bad. The goaltending was struggling. He wasn't getting the save, and that led to him being dismissed. I think he'd be the first one to tell you that when you go from college to NHL, it's a different pace, right? It's not two games a week. It's like three and four sometimes. A lot of travel, a lot of things. And that was probably a learning curve for him. You know, he kept the same staff that was there. When he got let go, he could have went back to college and probably been comfortable for the next 20 years. Instead, he took a job in Toronto working under Mike Babcock and then ultimately Sheldon Keith. So he's got six now years of experience in the league. And I just think he's a different coach. We interviewed him a year ago, September, in the summertime. Really liked, you know, the way he answered questions, very direct, and listened to what you had to say. And his message was very clear. And I think in today's game, that's important with the players. And I think he wants the players to do well. And I think he'll do a great job for us, you know, as our first head coach.
I'm intrigued. Did you call him, or did he apply for the job?
I believe I called Kyle and asked for permission to talk to him the first time. And then, you know, and a lot of credit to him too. I mean, we interviewed him multiple times and it never got out on his end either. So, you know, it was good to see as the process went along. We just liked the person, liked the coach, liked his message, and give him every chance to be successful here in Seattle.
So how difficult is it to keep a secret in Seattle versus what it was like in Carolina?
Yeah, I don't know. Our group has been, I've been amazed with it, not just in the hockey side. You know, we had the deal with Amazon and Climate Pledge Arena, and the word was if it leaked that the deal was going to get, canceled. And yet we told our 120 people that were on the weekly staff calls, and it never got out, which says a lot about our organization. The brand launch, you know, nobody really knew about that until it got out. And in fact, it was ironic the night before I'm talking to our people and they said they're overnighting me a bag with the logo in it for the launch, because I had to do some interviews the next day. And they said the combination code to the lock is, you know, yada, yada, yada. And I said, combination code? They said, yeah. So the next morning I'm up my front steps at 8 a.m. looking for my bag with the jersey and stuff in it. And there's no bag. So I start calling FedEx, can't find it. Turns out they delivered it to a warehouse an hour north of where I was at the time in North Carolina. And if there had not been a lock on that, that bag would have been opened and everything would have been leaked hours before. But kudos to our staff that thought about that. And thank God the person at the warehouse was nice enough to drive it down, so I had it in time to do the interviews. But as an organization, they've just, you know, sort of kept things internally. And we did the same thing on the hockey announcement, the coaching announcement.
One of the other things, I mean, I've talked to many people who've launched franchises over the years, and especially when you launch a new sport to a marketplace. And I'm guessing in Carolina, you did the chicken dinner circuit like crazy, selling the game. You know, every club, organization, somebody from your team goes there, has the crummy chicken dinner and does the speech. Are you doing the chicken dinner circuit in Seattle, or is this market sophisticated enough and have enough hockey history in it that you really don't have to do much of it?
Yeah, no, I haven't been doing a lot of chicken dinners, as you call them. So, I think as an organization, we've done a good job of reaching out to the community, letting them know that we want to be involved in it, not just asking for them to give to organization, but we're giving back. For instance, our ownership group, again, when we launched our logo, it would have been easy to take the profits in the first 30 days, but instead all the merchandise they sold had to say release the Kraken, and 100% of net proceeds were donated back to three different youth charities within the city of Seattle. So they've given a lot back to the community, let them know we're a part of it. But as far as hockey knowledge, there's a lot of hockey knowledgeable people in this market already. So that's been exciting to see.
Hey, Ronnie, is there a different attitude East Coast? You were on two East Coast states in Pennsylvania. You're now in Washington State. You're on the other side of the continent. Is there a different attitude to the game of hockey in the Pacific than there is in the East?
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting, still sort of finding my way through that, John. I mean, I played my whole career in the East. My post-hockey stuff was in the East. So this is really my first venture out to the West. So it's been kind of interesting to see. But, so far the people of Seattle have been very excited about the team, very knowledgeable. I mean, you walk around the city and people are saying hello and good luck, or you stop in a restaurant and they're writing on your ticket, go Kraken. So there's a lot of excitement for us to get the opening night and get this underway. I was standing outside a construction site the other day waiting for a ride, and the police officer was telling me he waited 51 years to buy his tickets for this. This is so exciting. Him and his wife got their tickets seven rows behind the bench, and he can't wait for us to get going. So, in a lot of ways, it still has that same sort of enthusiasm, no matter what market you're in. The fans are excited about the game, and I think that's exciting as to how it works. Once we get into it, I think it'll be a little more intense in this market just because it is such a sports town, but we're excited about the challenge.
Any doubt that Vancouver's your biggest rival?
No, I mean, that's the one geographically which is the closest, and that should be the biggest rival for us, just because it's a 2.5-hour drive for sure.
Last couple of questions for me, and they're kind of related. First of all, is it possible for you to be optimistic about how your team will do? And secondly, is there any pressure to succeed quickly because of what happened with Vegas? We're all old enough to remember that it usually takes 8, 10, 12 years to build a franchise to the point where it actually can compete. Vegas kind of blew that out of the water. So how do you feel about your team, and how do you feel about the pressure of trying to duplicate or come close to what Vegas was able to achieve?
Yeah, I think from day one, we said we're different than Vegas. Certainly, we'd like to duplicate that success if we could. But I think based on some of the challenges we talked about earlier, that's, maybe not as realistic out of the gate, but we certainly feel optimistic about the team we've put together and what we might be able to accomplish. I know in a lot of my discussions with our ownership group, I think part of the reason why I was hired was because what happened in Carolina and how that team was sort of built from the draft and from the ground up. And I think that's an important also angle to what we're trying to do here, right? So we're trying to put a team on the ice that's as competitive and successful as possible. We also want to make sure that we're drafting properly, developing properly. So as these kids mature and get there, we're going to be where we want to be, not just for 1 or 2 years, but year after year, hopefully be competitive, moving forward. And that's kind of the goal right from day one for the ownership group, which, there's pressure to win and be successful, but it's also pressure to do it right.
And you haven't, you haven't really started playing anything, and guys are skating, I guess, but any sense for how good this team you think might be?
Well, yeah, I haven't lost a game in the 2 years I've been on the job, so that's pretty
Congratulations.
Good.
Congratulations, yeah.
That's going to change. I know that's coming. I think we've got a nice mix of veteran guys and young guys. I think we've got a lot of guys that maybe now they hopefully can spread their wings a little bit, and we're hoping to see them sort of take the next step. I think we've got a good mix of sort of that exuberance, but also that leadership in the locker room too that can help steer the ship. And I think we've got a real good coaching staff. So we're optimistic about what we might be able to accomplish. And we'll see when the puck drops where we're at. But certainly feel we've got some really good players in that locker room that can help us be
Doesn't hurt to have a guy like Mark Giordano around. And what a leader he could be. He could be, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but he should be your next captain. Your first captain.
We'll see what the coaching staff, everybody wants to do, whether we want to put a C on somebody or go with some A's out of the gate. But certainly a guy with Mark's stature, everything he's accomplished in the game, on the ice, but just remarkable. You read about what he's done, he and his family in the community in Calgary. And, those are the kind of people that when you're getting to build your tradition, establish your reputation as an organization, those are the kind of guys you want to be a part of it, right? You only get one chance to do it right, and guys like that help you do that.
I guess the key thing for me is, do you have enough goal scoring? Is that if we look back at this first year, will you think that that's going to be your toughest question?
Yeah, no, as I said, we think our goaltending is real strong. We think our D is real good and deep. And the question is, can we score enough goals? And that's sort of yet to be determined. So, we think we've got some good players. We got some guys that can score goals. Can we figure out the power play? Can we be good on the penalty kill so we don't need to score as many, maybe some nights? But those are the questions that sort of need to be answered still.
Nice to talk to you while you're still undefeated. And with any luck, that'll last a little while longer. You must be getting pretty excited, though. You're just a few days away from really launching this thing for real. And we wish you great success. We thank you very much for taking some time for us today. And we look forward to the opportunity to chat somewhere down the road, maybe in the middle of your inaugural season here. Thank you, Ronnie, and all the best to you.
My pleasure, guys. Glad to be a part of this. And love to have you guys out in Seattle sometime, see our rink and see our team play, and just sort of see what it's all about, because I think you'd be excited to share on that.
Happy to do it. John, of course, is from not that far up the road, so you maybe drop in at home on a road trip. Thank you, Ron. All the best to you.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Take care.
Ron Francis, the general manager of the Seattle Kraken, will be back after this. So our thanks to Ron Francis for joining us.
Now, you met Ron before?
Not in person.
Okay.
And I don't think I've met him in like this kind of scenario. And for those that are listening on the radio, this is a Zoom call. So I think y'all are familiar with that. I don't think he was ever in studio with me, but I'm positive we did talk on the phone. Mm. So, So visually,
I've known Ronnie since he was 18 years old, and when he was a rookie for the Hartford Whalers. And, I also remember one of my favorite stories was when he got traded to the Maple Leafs. I don't know if you remember, he played briefly for the Toronto Maple Leafs. As sophisticated and as eloquent and as calming as Ron is, Ron had no idea what it was like to be a player in a hockey market like Toronto. And I remember standing with him one day after a game. He says, John, I got to go. Because they're going to follow me back to the hotel. I said, what do you mean? He says, oh, there'll be 60 fans. I'm going to try to go wend my way. It was Air Canada Center then. He was staying at the Royal York. I'm going to try to wend my way to the hotel, but there'll be 60 people following me up the street. I got to find a way to get back to the hotel. And it was a huge eye opener for him after playing in Hartford, playing in Carolina, playing in Pittsburgh, of the intensity of playing in a Canadian hockey market and one in Toronto, where there was an expectation the team that he joined was supposed to go to the Stanley Cup final.
Well, that's the reality of the big smoke, as we say.
Yeah.
Well, it's almost going to be impossible for the Kraken to achieve probably anything close to what the Golden Knights did. I mean, that story was so remarkable. I think we'll be talking about it, you know, well, somebody will be 20, 30, 50 years from now, because it's never happened in the history of expansion in any sport. And I don't see any reason to think that the Kraken can come even close to that. But if
and yet they might be a playoff, they might be fighting for a playoff spot, Bob. If you look at that division they're in with Vegas, the three California teams, Calgary, Edmonton, Vancouver. And let's face it, the three California teams, Anaheim, San Jose, LA, are rebuilding. Vegas obviously is the best team in the division. Edmonton should be close. Calgary and Vancouver are, how would you describe it? In transition. You know, I don't know what you say. Seattle could, if they're able to find their goal scoring issue, and fix it, because they do have a really good defense and they do have good goaltending.
They're not going to fix it, John. You don't fix that kind of thing with one player. You fix it with two or three players minimum. And they're not going to be able to acquire two or three players that are significant goal scorers. They're going to have
challenge. I mean, Jordan Eberle and Brandon Tanev are going to have to score goals. You know, I mean, that's the bottom line.
They're going to have to win a lot of 2-1 hockey games.
Yeah.
You know, as they used to say, you're going to have to play kitty bar the door. And they're going to have to rely on good goaltending. And I think you would agree they have a decent defense.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if it's great, but it's a decent defense. But their goaltender is going to have to stand on his head, whoever they put in on a given night. And they're just not going to be able to score many goals.
Yeah, no, you're right. That's right. And I do think the philosophy difference between what Vegas did. Vegas knew it needed to be good right away in order to try to own the market and grasp the market. And they did that. And then they sold they've sold the experience of being at T-Mobile. This is a little different. This is a team, as Ronnie talked about, is that they're going to be gradual in growth and they can afford to be patient because there isn't going to be a ticket available beyond the season ticket base, I would suggest, for 10 years in Seattle. When you think about all of the, you know, they've got 17,000 season tickets. They've got a waiting list. They had 32,000 people. I mean, and here's the interesting thing too, Bob. The arena presentation guy in Vegas, the guy that made the real difference, that created the atmosphere, he now works in Seattle. The Kraken hired him. So we are going to see a similar in-arena experience at Kraken games that people witnessed at T-Mobile. And we might see the two loudest arenas in the Pacific Division are in Vegas Seattle.
Well, I think you're right. And I mean, I've said this many times before. I moved to Vegas in the 80s. And at that time, it was the UNLV Runnin' Rebels basketball team was the only game in town. And that arena was electric. I mean, electric. It was, I mean, any sport, this is not about that it was basketball versus hockey or college versus pro. It was just intense.
Yeah.
And they took a lot of that and moved it over to the Golden Knights.
Yeah.
And
well,
I think every team now will look at that experience and look at the electricity that exists in that arena, in the T-Mobile arena, and they're going to aspire to it. And I'm not surprised that the Kraken have done the same thing.
Well, and then on the Seattle side of that is we know the Seahawks and their crowds are wild.
Yep.
We know that the soccer team, the MLS team, the Sounders, has won the MLS championship a couple times. Their crowds are wild. This is a passionate fan base, a passionate city about sports. It's going to be a home run in so many ways, on so many levels. And if they win games, that's going to be a bonus. It's going to be a bonus, Bob.
You think the NBA goes back to Seattle?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
With a hockey team there now, huh?
Sure. Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Seattle is a great basketball town. I mean, the WNBA team, it still is. The WNBA team, the Storm, they are the blueprint for every women's basketball, professional basketball team. They are fantastic. Sue Bird and all those players have done a great job in that town.
I get it.
They have not forgotten their pedigree as being a basketball town. Seattle has not forgotten its pedigree. No question.
Yeah. Well, it's just with a hockey team there, you know, there are limitations in every market, but, and Seattle is not a mega market. It's a good sized market, but can you succeed with four or arguably five major professional sports teams in the market?
And don't forget, they have really good college sports in Seattle too, the Washington Huskies. Even though the Huskies lost to Michigan on the weekend.
Oh, you mean a Pac-10 team lost to a
Pac-12, Bob. It's Pac-12.
Pac-12 team lost. Well, it used to be Pac-10.
Yeah, it used to be Pac-8, Bob.
Yeah. They lost to a Big Ten team who has like 50 members in the Big Ten.
Yeah. So Washington loses to Michigan, but Oregon beats
Ohio State.
Ohio State.
In the horseshoe.
There you go.
Yeah, it'd be a while for me to get over that. Thanks to Ron Francis for joining us today. For John Shannon, Bob McCown. We'll see you tomorrow. Goodbye, everybody.